This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
There's no clarity here. I mean, there's a he said, she said. And the fact that you have Mobile Gas's own employees saying, yes, the gauge read this and this and this, and that's an important discussion to shine a light on.
According to the Supreme Court, corporations are people. The absurdity of this statement notwithstanding, it's clear that, like people, corporations make mistakes and sometimes commit crimes and atrocities. Today on Sea Change Radio, we talk with two experts about the impact that two energy corporations have had on actual people. First, I speak with Inside Climate News reporter Neela Banerjee about the stark contrast between what happened at Aliso Canyon and what happened in Mobile, Alabama, when gas and chemical spills contaminated the communities there. The same company, Sempra Energy, was involved, and yet the response and aftermath were vastly different, with race and class factoring significantly into environmental justice outcomes. Then we talk with John Wilson, head of corporate governance at Cornerstone Capital Group, about the death of former Chesapeake Energy CEO Aubrey McClendon. Facing widespread accusations that he cheated landowners out of the money they were promised in exchange for letting Chesapeake Energy drill for natural gas on their property, Chesapeake's founder died in mysterious fashion recently. Wilson gives us his environmental, social, and corporate governance perspective on the corruption allegations and the demise of the man Forbes magazine once called the world's most reckless billionaire. I'm joined again on Sea Change Radio by Neela Banerjee. She writes for Inside Climate News. Neela, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
So you wrote a terrific piece in March chronicling the chemical spill in Alabama, and it was eerily similar to the Aliso Canyon leak in Los Angeles last year that got uncovered. It's entitled A Tale of Two Leaks, Fixed in California, Ignored in Alabama. First, why don't you tell us some of the similarities between these two spills?
Well, what happened in Alabama and what happened in Aliso Canyon and the health effects and aggravation that people experienced are tied together by one chemical, and it's called mercaptan. So when you turn on your gas stove and you smell that rotten egg smell, that is mercaptan. It's a chemical that is added to natural gas so that leaks of natural gas can be detected, because natural gas itself, which is mostly methane, does not have a smell. In Aliso Canyon, there was a storage well that already had gas in it that had been treated with mercaptan. It began to leak, and it was not an explosion risk, but the smell of the mercaptan that was so foul that people who lived near the storage facility were sickened by it, were irritated by it, and they ended up being evacuated. In 8 Mile, Alabama, a small town outside of Mobile, it wasn't the gas itself. It was the mercaptan before it's added to the gas, and it leaked into the soil and then into the groundwater, and then it came up to bodies of water like ponds, and it would evaporate from there, and that also sickened people and irritated their respiratory systems and so on.
And then the thing that really kind of struck a nerve with me when I read it was how these two different leaks were handled. One in Aliso Canyon was in an upscale, mostly white neighborhood in Southern California.
That's right.
The other was in a poor black neighborhood in Alabama. It doesn't seem like a coincidence that these were handled differently.
Right. I don't think it is a coincidence, and that's why we decided to look into it. We actually found out about the leak of mercaptan in 8 Mile, Alabama, when we were covering the Aliso Canyon leak. And again, that's the natural gas here. It was a chemical. We tried to find out if there was any literature about long-term health effects from exposure to mercaptan. And there was a peer-reviewed study that was done of this community, this tiny little community outside of Mobile called 8 Mile. So once we started to look into it, we saw that it was the chemical itself that had leaked into the earth, and people were still smelling it, and it occurred 8 years ago. But the big difference was in Aliso Canyon, as soon as people started to complain and the gas company discovered that its storage well was leaking, people were evacuated, there were calls for action, there were all sorts of steps to, there were calls for action both against the company but also for regulatory action. In 8 Mile, people started to complain in 2008, then in 2010. There's a small community around it. It's mostly black. It's working class to more professional class. And the gas company said nothing was wrong. And even though it had actually come in and cleaned up a little bit of the spill in 2008. And this continued for a while. And to this day, nobody's been evacuated from there. And the only recourse that people have been able to find or have turned to is that they've gone to plaintiff's lawyers who've sued the company and then settled not on health grounds but on nuisance grounds, saying, this has created a nuisance, and they get a settlement. But the settlements, from what I hear, are not enough for people to recoup the value of their property and live elsewhere. And if you're a renter, then you're really out of luck.
Yes, you quote an activist in the community who says they get $10,000, and that's not even going to cover like much of their health care benefits when they get sick, and they're not going to be able to sell their house, and they're not going to be able to buy another house with that kind of money.
Right. We don't know how much they got because under the terms of the settlements, they can't discuss
that. And they can't sue, right?
And they can't sue. And again, there's so little knowledge of long-term of the impact of long-term low-level exposure to mercaptan that, if people get sick or their kids, get sick 10, 15, 20 years from now, I don't think they have any recourse. I'm sure that the part of the settlement is that, you can't sue even on other grounds such as health.
The difference between the working class low-income community versus the middle to high-income community in California is that these people in LA had an option. They had more leverage. They had more threats legally, and they also were not between a rock and a hard place like these people in Alabama seem to be.
No, they weren't. I mean, I think it was a number of things. I think, first of all, they were in California, right, as opposed to Alabama. I mean, California takes its regulatory responsibilities, including environmental ones, more seriously than Alabama does. There's a much more laissez-faire attitude toward the environment, towards companies in the South. And I say that as a Southerner, somebody who grew up in Cancer Alley in Louisiana. And so that's one of the big differences, is the way the authorities respond to these kinds of problems. And then the second issue, the second difference is that, this is a community in Aliso Canyon that has a lot of money. They have a lot of clout. The Secretary of State of California was one of the residents there, and his family had to be evacuated. So you had powerful people living there, who could make a lot of noise and who could also spare the time and resources to organize and to really raise a hue and cry over this. The people in 8 Mile, there were some folks who tried to organize, but, there's also discussion that a lot of people, when they discovered that there was a leak and, that this mercaptan had seeped into the groundwater, and this is not drinking water, right, but this is there are ponds and such there, and the mercaptan evaporates from the ponds, and you can smell it in the neighborhood. They probably thought, here I am, I'm a black person out in Alabama, and the best I can get, I'll be able to get, is a settlement, is some money to take care of my needs. There are activists who say, there's a certain fatalism that comes with living in Alabama and, the history of being black in Alabama. And a lot of people, rather than organizing together and banding together, felt that they couldn't do better in these circumstances but to sue. And so that, that also meant that there wasn't as much of a hue and cry raised in Alabama. Though, I mean, there's certainly people who are working very hard to hold the company and the state authorities accountable, but it's not as unified as you're seeing out in California. And then finally, it's the fact is, in a society like ours, people take, you know, the pain and suffering of white people more seriously than they do of black people. I mean, and especially in the South. I mean, it's just, and that's the way this society operates, and it's a tough fight against it.
She's got a cigarette on each arm. She's got the lily white cavity crazes. She's got a carburetor tied to the moon. Her fingers looking to the food of the ages. She's alone in the new illusion. She's alone in the new illusion. Got a hand on the wheel of fate. She can talk to the mangled strangers. She can sleep in a fiery bomb. Throw her troubles to the dying embers. She's alone in the revolution. She's alone in the...
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Neela Banerjee. She's a reporter for Inside Climate News. Neela, I'm glad you brought up the state comparison because there was a sentence in your article. I wanted to ask you more about it. You write, the Environmental Protection Agency has deferred to the state of Alabama because mercaptan is not considered a hazardous material. So I wanted to know, did the EPA defer to the state of California in the Aliso Canyon case, and how is mercaptan not considered a hazardous material?
I think in California, the state regulators are also taking the lead. But to get to your point about why is mercaptan not considered a hazardous material, I think what you and I would define as hazardous is different from the government's definition. I think because mercaptan has not been shown to have grave short-term or long-term health effects, it's considered more of a nuisance than a hazard. Now, part of the reason that it, you know, who knows why there hasn't been the study of long-term, you know, health effects of exposure to mercaptan. I mean, maybe if we had more science, we'd understand, you know, what the impact is, what the consequences are from this exposure. But we don't know. So based on the material out there, the EPA is like, you know, this isn't going to really sicken people. This isn't going to kill them. So it's not a hazard. At least that's my understanding of it.
So Neela, maybe you can explain how it gets a bit fuzzy when it comes to how much of this chemical mercaptan was actually spilled near Mobile, Alabama.
Now, mercaptan, you can be exposed to a very tiny amount of it and still really smell it and really be sickened by it, you know, and you know, be nauseated or get headaches or respiratory reactions to it. I mean, that.
So 200 gallons is a lot then.
200 gallons could be a lot. You know, I don't know. The problem was that this was an issue that kept coming up, including in local press coverage about it. And what happened was that for reasons that I couldn't get to the bottom of in the time that I had for the story, despite my best efforts, there were conflicts between Mobile Gas, you know, who owned the tank of mercaptan, and the companies that it hired to clean it up. Mobile Gas at that time did not have its own environmental cleanup unit, so they hired local contractors. And then they and Mobile Gas actually started suing one another, right? Hmm. And then there were the residents who sued, you know, Mobile Gas. So as part of all of this, there were depositions taken. And what emerged from the plaintiff's attorneys as they sort of, you know, talked to all of these actors was that that there were times when this tank of mercaptan got to empty, which was really weird. I mean, the tank is like some kind of 500-gallon tank, and they might use maybe 200 gallons a year, but it was registering empty at various times from late 2007 to 2008. So one of the plaintiff's lawyers was trying to get to the bottom of this, like, what does this mean? And he was suspicious that more could have been spilled. And it seemed like, to him at least, in these depositions, Mobile Gas did not have a sort of a satisfactory answer to that. Now, what Mobile Gas has said is like, look, it was an accounting error or it was a broken gauge, but, you know, we did not spill more than 200 gallons. And the spill itself, what they said happened was that pipe had been damaged, had been ruptured by a lightning strike. And so, you know, their workers went there just to inspect. They smelled it. They looked. They found this and so on. But the plaintiff's lawyer said these leaks occurred even before the lightning strike occurred. So nobody's been able to get to the bottom of that.
I looked at it cynically because when a company says, well, it was either an accounting error or it was a broken gauge, like, or there was a lightning strike that they didn't figure out caused a leak until much later. It seems like, how are we supposed to believe them when it comes to that figure, you know?
There's no clarity here. I mean, there's a he said, she said. And the fact that you have Mobile Gas's own employees saying, yes, the gauge read this and this and this, and the things they were citing were significant drops in the volume of that gas, not of the gas, but of mercaptan, of the liquid itself. I mean, that's an important discussion to shine a light on.
So where are we now with this case?
I'm not sure how much has changed there. I mean, maybe there's starting to be a bit more scrutiny. We know that the NAACP's central office in Maryland has spoken to me about the situation down there, and I've put them in touch with local residents and activists. I don't know what the state of those discussions is. I think, you know, greater media interest also ratchets up the demand for accountability from state officials. And so I'm not quite sure what's happening there. I mean, I think on a day-to-day basis, what's happening is that there's the state has these odor patrols that run in the area. And they check to see whether, you know, there's a smell of mercaptan, and they do pick it up. You know, they have picked up the smell that the residents complain about, and the residents to this day, you know, it's they say it's, you know, it's kind of hard to tell, but it's usually in the evenings, and the odor persists, right? So basically, not a whole lot has changed for them. But there's still people working to make sure that something happens. Whether they'll succeed is unclear.
Neela Banerjee of Inside Climate News, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by my friend John Wilson. He's the head of corporate governance and engagement and research at Cornerstone Capital Group, and he's also an adjunct professor at Columbia University. John, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Alex.
John, let's talk for a minute about the demise of Chesapeake Energy's CEO, Aubrey McClendon. You've met him. Why don't you talk first about why he was an important character in the energy space and what went wrong?
So Aubrey McClendon was the CEO and chairman and actually the founder of Chesapeake Energy. Chesapeake Energy is a natural gas exploration company. So what they do is they basically go around, they buy up land, and they try to dig for natural gas. And they were really the pioneers, one of the pioneers among companies, in the fracking, hydraulic fracturing, horizontal drilling, these new techniques that are very controversial, but at the same time have increased the supply of natural gas that we've been able to produce over the last 10 or 20 years. So he was really a pioneer of this. I mean, back in the 90s or the 80s or the 90s when he got started, people basically thought that we were running out of fossil fuels. We had a lot of conversation about peak oil and peak gas as well. And he didn't believe that. He believed that there were lots of opportunities to be had in this space, and he went out and he really went full bore to get these resources into the marketplace. Now, the problem with Aubrey ultimately was he was ambitious, he was driven, he was smart, he was a great deal maker, but he also had no off switch, right? So he was always pushing forward at the fastest pace possible. And one of the central things, we talk about corporate governance, right? Corporate governance is really about how you oversee on the behavior of managers on behalf of shareholders, right? How do we make sure that managers are behaving in a way that is good for shareholders? And companies that are well governed can harness that kind of drive that he has without letting it get out of control. And in the case of Chesapeake, they didn't have the quality of corporate governance that would have allowed, his brand of aggressive deal making, to go forward without putting the company at risk, which is essentially what happened.
Explain what Chesapeake got in trouble for doing.
A lot of things. the first thing is they started to give him kinds of compensation packages that were very unusual in the industry. They were actually allowing him to invest directly and personally in the same wells that the company was investing in. And they were loaning him money to do that. And they were allowing him to use the wells as collateral for the loans. So he was stood to make a whole bunch of money personally when those wells succeeded. And that's kind of a conflict of interest. And that was one big concern that people had about him.
It was like he was a movie star and they were giving him a percentage of the picture.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, exactly. And in the movie business, that's okay. But in the well business, it's not. The problem was that he was making decisions, about where to put the resources of the company, operational decisions. Everybody worked for him. And so when he's invested personally, then the question is he thinking about his personal investment or is he thinking about the company?
Right. It's like especially when you're considering things that maybe, well, this well isn't as productive as we'd want. Let's just write it off as a sunk cost. But if he has a vested interest in seeing it through, he may not do the right thing for the company is what you're saying.
Exactly. Or, it may simply be that he doesn't put up any of his own money for this. And so he may just want to take a whole lot of risks because if they pay off, he strikes it rich. If they don't pay off, the downside for him is not as great. And so, and in fact, that's kind of what happened, right? I mean, he got personally loaded up with debt. The company got loaded up with debt. And basically everything was great until the price of natural gas started to fall, right? And where have we seen this before? I mean, it's very similar to the housing market.
Yeah, housing market. And I just saw a Frontline piece on Saudi Arabia. When the price of gas fell, there's a lot of people all around the globe who felt the reverberations of that.
Absolutely. And people in developing countries who depend on their government's oil revenue for their basic livelihoods are in a real, pickle these days. But anyway, so that's, so we see this all the time. Warren Buffett once said, when the tide goes out, you see who's been swimming naked, right? And so that's basically what happened here. Suddenly, they were finding themselves with a lot of debt that was increasingly difficult to pay and make payments on because of the revenues weren't coming in quite as much. Aubrey himself had to sell a lot of his shares to cover his own debts, which actually drove the price of the company down and created some financial stress on the company. And then eventually, eventually what happened was some activist investors, Carl Icahn, came in and, said, look, we've had enough of this. We need some adult supervision here. Put his own people on the board. And those people ultimately fired McClendon and brought in someone else who's actually started to try to clean up the mess at Chesapeake. So the company is trying to make a turnaround, but in this price environment, it's just really hard. There's just not a lot of revenues to do it.
One thing we haven't discussed is his untimely death. It was pretty fishy. Why don't you explain how this all unfolded recently?
Sure. I mean, the timing of this is notable, shall I say, because he had just been indicted. There's lawsuits going on and indictments having to do with him getting together with some of his business partners to, you know, make some transactions whose intent was to reduce the prices being paid to landowners. And you'll know that, you know, one of the reasons why communities accept fracking into their communities is because the landowners get paid royalties for the gas that gets brought out of their land. And so it's a key part of this whole supply chain. But McClendon and his, and, you know, basically what they were doing is they were colluding. It was, you know, kind of almost like an antitrust kind of thing, where they were trying to drive down the landowner royalties in order to get more payments for themselves. That's what's being alleged. So obviously, those trials are not, at least as far as McClendon goes, are not going to be are not going to go forward. But anyway, so he got into this car accident literally like a day after this indictment came down, and a few days. After his, you know, his most significant investor pulled his investment from him, so it's very suspicious, as you say. We don't know exactly. I think there's no way for us or anybody to know why this happened, but.
And it could be a suicide, right? I mean, the guy was going really fast and without a seatbelt. At the very least, that was reckless.
Exactly. He was going very fast without a seatbelt. So some people have suggested that it could be a suicide. Again, I don't think we'll ever know for sure. But it's, you know, it's certainly an end that it brings to an end our ability to find out exactly what was going on. And there was certainly a lot going on at the company at that time, and with him personally, you know, even after he left the company. So unfortunately, and obviously, it's a terrible tragedy for him and his family, but also for us in our desire to kind of get to the bottom of these kinds of things. It certainly ends a lot of opportunity to learn important information.
What takeaways has the ESG community had from McClendon's downfall?
Yeah, I mean, and I think this is really, it is a great example and maybe a cautionary tale about the need for corporate governance. Corporate governance is a topic that not too many people think about. It's kind of obscure and technical, but it really goes to this question of how do companies make decisions? And on whose behalf are those decisions made, right? Are they being made in the best long-term interests of shareholders? Are other stakeholders like landowners, like communities who want clean air and clean water being taken into account, right? Those decisions are made in part because of the kinds of structures you have in place. If you have a strong board, which Chesapeake certainly did not, but maybe does now, they will restrain the worst impulses. I mean, it's only natural for someone, you know, in a position of power to try to, you know, go as far as possible, to get as much as possible. It's natural. We're all ambitious, but we need to have people, you know, who are saying, okay, let's take a look at this. Is this really what's best for our communities, our shareholders, our employees, and so forth? And you need to have the right incentives in place. And this was really the problem, you know, with, we talked about earlier, his compensation, right? Giving him so much of the upside of these wells created an incentive to, you know, be reckless. And I think there was actually a magazine cover at the time saying he was the most reckless CEO in America, you know, and I wouldn't say it's because of him personally. I would say it's because this is what he was given incentive to do. And by the way, Lehman Brothers, AIG, same situation, right? Incentives to take risks, lots of upside, not much downside. And you see what happens. It's human nature.
He's the head of corporate governance at Cornerstone Capital Group, John Wilson. John, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Melvin Sparks, Beck, and Robert Palmer. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.